Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here, and I hope to, this afternoon at least, to have an opportunity to talk to you about these projects that I'll describe or anything else that we might be able to interact on. And I'll talk to you today mainly about, I'm going to try to get as close as I can to telling you about the projects that have been occupying my group this summer. One is to try to make a new phase of liquid crystals in which the molecules that make the liquid crystal are semiconductor rods. Okay? So that's one project. A second one I'll show you is a set of experiments where cells eat quantum dots, and we can use that to do something that the biologists find of use. And then the third one, if there's time, I don't know if there will be experiments where we try to use DNA in order to encode the assembly or to program the assembly of arrangements of nanoparticles. So particles will come into contact with each other because the DNA is directing them to do this. So those are the three projects I'll try to describe. Oops, what just happened to me there? That was at the end. Sorry. I repeat this slide at both the beginning and the end. So, all right. Let's go to the beginning. Okay. So here you see the starting point, which is that we can make colloidally in liquid solutions small semiconductor crystals. For example, in this case, you see cadmium selenide crystals, and you just see a great big field of them, and they're each crystal is surrounded by a monolayer of surfactant. So they don't quite look exactly like the quantum dots that are grown by molecular beam epitaxy that maybe people here are more familiar with. They're grown in a liquid solution, and in the end, they're prevented from aggregation because of this coating of a monolayer of soap. And the idea here is to try very hard, and probably never successfully, to emulate the incredible structures that are made by MBE, which have precision and beauty, and to try in some rinky-dink apparatus of very low quality to emulate it. Never to get it to the same level, perhaps, but to get as close as we can slowly hope to. And so in our version of things, and I want to cite, you know, Mike Steigerwald and Munji Bawendi and Chris Murray have all done really important work on developing this, and we've worked on this a long time. Let's take some precursors, which in the MBE machine also would make a semiconductor like cadmium selenide or indium arsenide, and just inject them into a very hot liquid soap, at which point inside there, crystals will nucleate homogeneously in solution. They won't aggregate because the surfactant molecules come on and off very quickly, but on average, the surfactants are on there, okay? So atoms can get in and out, but you won't get aggregation. And it turns out that in this way, you can grow crystals. This is getting to be an old slide now, but here you see the ensemble photoluminescence spectra from a series of different nanocrystals of different diameter. So this is, say, you've made on the order of 100 milligrams of nanocrystal in a few minutes by injecting into the precursors into the soap and trying to control the kinetics so that the size that comes out is size controlled. And of course, you see the quantum size effect. The band gap depends on the size of the crystal. And the way in which we control sizes is this concept that I just want to tell you briefly about because it leads to all the rest. And that's this concept of size distribution focusing. So look here at the size as a function of time. Right after one of those injections, the crystals grow very fast because it's a supersaturated solution of precursor. There's monomers that can add onto the crystals. There's a lot of them around. The crystals grow quickly. When you use up the monomer, they start to grow very slowly. But notice the standard deviation. During the period when the crystals grow quickly, they spontaneously become more tightly distributed. The distribution is becoming more narrow when the crystals are growing quickly, whereas when they're growing slowly, it's broadening out. And it really is related to the rates because we can make another injection and then we'll see that the crystals again have their size distribution narrow. So whenever they're growing fast, the distribution is spontaneously becoming more narrow, whereas when they're growing slowly, the distribution is broadening out. And this can be understood using classical nucleation theory. Here you see growth rate as a function of size. And as you probably know, there's always a peak in a curve like this for growth rate as a function of size. If a crystal is too small, it will disappear because of the surface energy. And if it's larger, it will grow. But of course, if you plot growth rate versus size, there is a peak in the curve because it just takes many more atoms to make a large crystal bigger in diameter. So there's a peak in this curve. And now what we can do is there's this critical size, that's the size that's at equilibrium. There's a certain amount of monomer around. That monomer will be at equilibrium with a particular size. In other words, as long as that size is present, it will neither disappear nor grow. Okay? We can manipulate that critical size by changing the monomer concentration. So that's this crossing here. So let's say that I have an average size right here where this black line is, and this is the critical size because of the monomer that's present. Then I'll have some small crystals disappearing and some large ones growing. But if I put in a whole bunch of monomer, I shift this curve over, and now suddenly you see small crystals will grow faster than large ones, and the distribution will spontaneously focus. And that's the basis of making these crystals narrow in size. They're much narrower than the size distribution that you would get if you just had the statistics of atoms plating out onto nuclei. And we can do size distribution focusing, so not just in the case of cadmium selenide, but in cobalt as well. Beautiful work being done these days at IBM by Chris Murray in the cobalt system. Here you see some work where we've taken a cobalt precursor and injected it into hot soap, and these crystals fall out of solution, and there's no further size selection. That's the size distribution that comes out after a few minutes. And you can see not just a monolayer, but a bilayer of these crystals. They're quite uniform. They're within the size distribution required to start to form crystals. And of course, in the two examples of cobalt I just showed you are small enough that their magnetic moments are just wandering at room temperature, and so they'll make these three-dimensional assemblies due to the van der Waals forces and the packing. Okay, but if the crystals become a little bit larger and they start to have locked magnetic moments, then you get all these other pretty patterns. For example, this nice Valentine, which we tried very hard, this was published last February in Science, but we missed by a couple of weeks and we didn't get Valentine's Day, and it was too bad. Now, I'm going to tell you about controlling shapes. So let's take the system of cadmium selenide, and if we stack the planes in cadmium selenide in the correct way, we'll get a hexagonal crystal structure like what you see here. And Zhaogang Peng had the idea, so you see these crystals are faceted, and they can have an elongated axis. And Zhaogang Peng had the idea, let's play, instead of one kind of soap, let's have two kinds of soap, and pick the soap so that they'll stick differentially to different faces of the crystal. That would provide us a means, therefore, of adjusting the growth rate of one crystal face with respect to another. It's a very simple idea, just there's two organic molecules and the crystals are growing in the presence of those, and the ratio of those two is going to modulate the relative growth rates of different faces of the crystals. And this works very well, so we have these two soaps here which stick differentially, and I'll show you how that works in a minute. But you see that under those conditions, we can make rod-like crystals. So here you see these rods of cadmium selenide that are, you know, maybe almost 100 nanometers long, but only a couple of nanometers wide, which are obtained under these same kinds of conditions, but just where these two surfactants are present. So one face now is growing many, many times faster than the sides of the barrel, and it just gets long. The mechanism of that is sort of what I mentioned to you a moment ago. We have two kinds of soap, and it turns out that if we look at cadmium selenide, it's a material that doesn't have inversion symmetry. It's got a unique crystallographic axis, and if you look at the atoms and how they stack, the tops and bottoms are chemically inequivalent, intrinsically chemically inequivalent. They couldn't be inverted into each other, and so the surfactant that we've chosen sticks strongly to one of these faces, but really doesn't stick to the other one at all. And that's the basic idea for how we can grow the rods and achieve the anisotropic growth. Now, we can do that not just in cadmium selenide. I showed you focusing for cadmium selenide, but we can also play the same game with cobalt and make rods of cobalt. So there are two surfactants present, and then there are different crystallographic faces of the cobalt that, again, play off against each other. And in this way, you can get rods. And one of the really neat things about the rods of cobalt, and this is sort of the theme of what we're going into, is how will these objects start to collectively arrange themselves. In the case of the cobalt, the rods will spontaneously make ribbons, and that's because the magnetic moments of adjacent rods antiferromagnetically couple, so you get these nice ribbons. And in the case of cobalt, you also see that all of our control truly is kinetic. So here you see the rods of cobalt, which are obtained just a few seconds after the injection into this binary surfactant mixture. But if the system's left hot for a while, then over a period of not so long, you know, a couple of thousand seconds, these rod-like crystals ultimately transform into spherical crystals, which is, of course, the equilibrium shape. Now, this view graph is actually a very complicated one. There's much more going on here than just rods going to spheres. It's going to take us a long time to unravel it, because, in fact, the crystal structure is changing as well. These are hexagonal close-packed rods of cobalt, and these are the epsilon phase of cobalt. So you see here that there's a transformation both of the shape and of the crystal structure. So it's going to take us a while to figure out the kinetics and the mechanisms of this, but qualitatively it shows the idea that we can obtain these very anisotropic shapes under kinetic control, very far from equilibrium growth, but then if we let the system go for a long time, it will just come out round. And here's just one other structure. You see a lot of these. These are the ribbons of cobalt. And so, as I mentioned, the ribbons go like so, antiferromagnetically coupled. But as you know, the magnetic dipoles would like to make chains. And so what happens is these ribbons form arcs, because in this direction they're antiferromagnetically coupled, and this way they make a closed loop. It's kind of a nice structure that forms spontaneously. What about the semiconductor rods? Langshi Li, who happens to be here, he's come with me today because there's a facility here for doing small angle X-ray scattering that we're trying to use while we're here today. And he had this idea, let's start to look at the assemblies of the semiconductor rods. Maybe they would form liquid crystals. And this was one of the initial observations that led him in that direction. This is just a monolayer of the cadmium selenide rods deposited onto a surface. And what you see is that the rods tend to make these very beautiful patterns where they're aligned orientationally over a certain distance, and then they're stacked, and that looks very much like a smectic liquid crystal phase. And so Langshi Li had the idea, well, maybe we could make real liquid crystals. And so now he is performing experiments where the rods are in solution. They're dissolved in a liquid, but they're at very high density inside the liquid. So there's a solvent, rods are inside, and at high density, and then observing those between crossed polarizers. So there's of course, if the rods have a local orientation, then they'll rotate the polarization of the light, and you can see modulations in the intensity that just you do like you do in a conventional or classic liquid crystal. So this is one of the observations. You see these when you have a very dense solution, and the density is slowly changing. The density of the solvent is slowly changing. So the system's becoming more and more dense, and suddenly you see these droplets show up. Okay, in crossed polarizers, see these droplets show up. That's the incipient formation of the liquid crystal domains. And if it goes just a little bit longer, I don't know, I hope you can see this okay, but if it goes just a little bit longer, you get these very beautiful patterns, which are liquid crystal domains now inside in the liquid of these semiconductor rods. Okay, and you know, this is very new results, and we're still just beginning to come to terms with it and figure out what the phases are. So I can't tell you actually what phase this is for sure, but it's a liquid crystal phase of the rods. And of course, you probably know that rod-like molecules, if they're dense enough, will spontaneously form liquid crystals. So there's no reason in principle why these should not do so. One thing that's kind of neat is that I think, unlike regular liquid crystals, organic liquid crystals, these particular kind can be imaged pretty successfully in the TEM. So Lee's been doing a bunch of experiments where you simply dry these things out onto a substrate and image and see what was there. Okay, and so here's just a huge layer of, quote, isotropic monolayer of 4 by 40 nanometer rods. And now you start to see other kinds of patterns. At a different density, you can get this so-called, you can see that in this case, the rods, these 4 by 40 rods, tend all to be aligned dominantly along this axis. Some are not, but dominantly along this axis. But there's no order in any other direction particularly. But under other conditions, you see that they start to form these stacks. These are multi-layers now, and we think that this is what was present in the liquid. So essentially we're imaging the phases, we think, that were present in the liquid, but using TEM. So you see here this more smectic-like phase where the layers are stacked. And here are smaller rods. One thing that we can do with this kind of system is we can change the rod length and the diameter over a very wide range without them bending too much. And it turns out that there's a lot of theory on what phases should form for rigid rods, and some of it has been tested, but these systems might provide a very nice test for those models because they really can be tuned over a very wide range while remaining rigid. So here you see a somewhat smaller size, again, the quote pneumatic multilayer, and here what looks like a smectic multilayer, where again the rods are kind of stacking in these layers. And then you get occasionally this kind of pattern, which we're still trying to understand, but this is a rod that's standing up, and then all the others make a vortex-like pattern around it. Okay? So lots of pretty pictures. Now let me just switch a little bit to some spectroscopy, just a couple of minutes of it. Because we can make these rods of different lengths and diameters, we do have an opportunity to go in and look at the electronic structure of these materials as a function of the length and the diameter. So let me show you a couple of things. The first is we can just measure the band gap or the luminescence energy as a function of the diameter and the length, and you see what you would expect. The band gap doesn't depend very much on the length, but does depend very strongly upon the diameter. This is an empirical pseudopotential calculation done in collaboration with Lin Wang Wang, who previously worked with Alex Zunger at NREL. And these are just calculations of the energy levels of the rods. And what you're supposed to see here is that there's one class of levels, for example, in the quote conduction band, that depend very, very strongly upon the length of the rod. And there's another set of levels that are essentially independent of the length. And the ones that depend very strongly on the length have no nodes as you go around the circle of the rod, whereas the ones that don't depend very much have a node as you go around. And I'll show you some of that. And also, you can see here in the occupied energy levels that there are a bunch of level crossings as a function of aspect ratio, many, many level crossings as a function of the aspect ratio, and some of those we can observe. So here are just pictures of the electronic levels. These are, for example, the unoccupied cadmium 5s, the bands that arise from the cadmium 5s atomic orbitals. And you just see they go up higher and higher in energy, and they correspond very beautifully to the what look like particle-in-the-box kind of levels, but coming out of this much more complicated model. And likewise, here are the valence bands, and what you notice here is that because these arise from selenium 4p orbitals, we need to consider the issue of the orientation of the selenium 4p orbitals with respect to the axis that's elongating. So if you like, we have the pxy selenium atomic orbitals that are making bands, and the pzs, and those are the ones that are crossing. All those crossings correspond to crossings of the pxy like bands that have PXY-like origins and those that have PZs. For example, this crossing here in a different aspect ratio, which is something we've been able to observe experimentally in the polarization. So let me show you here. This is the fluorescence emission from single nanorods, and as you rotate the polarization, you see that they're highly polarized. And you can study the degree of polarization of the rods as a function of their aspect ratio. And what you see is that the emission from the rods becomes highly polarized, almost as polarized as it can get, when you change the aspect ratio from 1 to just a little bit bigger than 2. So if you elongate, the rod is normally emitting depolarized light, or a dot is emitting depolarized light, but if it elongates to an aspect ratio of 2, then the emission is fully polarized. And that, it turns out, has its origin precisely in this crossing of the PXY orbital, which is the top of the valence band in the dot, and the PZ, which is the top in a slightly elongated rod. And you can see here also that the two energy levels, those two energy levels, the PXY and PZ, cross each other at a certain aspect ratio, and this is the aspect ratio as predicted in the theory and what's observed in the experiment. And you can see, please don't look at the actual numbers. No, if you do look at the numbers, you see the values don't quite agree quantitatively, but the pattern is certainly what's predicted. So that's just a little bit of spectroscopy. Back to growth. I'm going to show you some really exotic shapes. Let's take those rods and take them to the limit where the face that's growing fast grows really, really fast compared to all other faces, thousands of times faster instead of just quite a bit faster. Okay? Then you make arrows. And the reason is the following. This face now is super high energy compared to all other faces of the crystal. So it's growing, okay? It's growing very fast, and it's susceptible to a fluctuation where before one layer has finished, a second one has started. Okay? So that you start to get some layers that are incomplete, and every so often it will occur that a relatively low-index plane could appear here, which happens to be lower in energy than this one, but still higher than all of these. Okay? And that will occur just statistically every so often. But as soon as this one does appear, it completely takes over. Okay? It takes this face is just taken out of the picture, and this one now takes over. And the crystal starts to grow here and to make these arrowhead shapes, which you see here, lots of arrows. Okay, if you look in, here's an arrow that did us the favor of standing up, and it's pointing, and you can see it's a crystal all the way through, and that's the arrows. Now, here's the more exotic thing, and that has us kind of thinking is really an interesting problem, and not just a curiosity. And that is that I told you earlier that we have, normally when we're growing these hexagonal rods, we have a certain stacking sequence of planes. Okay? Now, that stacking sequence isn't immutable. You can have the wurtzite stacking, but you can also get zinc blend stacking. Okay? And that's the only difference between those two is whether you go ABC, ABC, or ABAB. Okay? Energy difference is really minuscule. It turns out there are conditions where we can make the system go ABAB or ABC, ABC by adjusting the temperature. Lower temperature favors the zinc blend sequence, and the higher temperature favors the wurtzite. And so what you see now is that if you look carefully at these two structures, they're very related to each other, and they share one crystallographic face. If we make a little pyramid of zinc blend, the four faces which are exposed are in fact exactly the face which is growing very fast when we make rods. So it is possible to make these four-armed structures, where first one nucleates a little pyramid of zinc blend pyramid, and then creates the conditions for rod growth, okay, and four rods project out of the four faces of the material. It's all one crystal still, four arms at the tetrahedral angle. And it turns out that you can go back and try to recreate the conditions that favor the formation of the pyramidal growth, okay, for making little pyramids, the zinc blend stacking sequences, and then go back again to the rods. And in principle, it's possible to iterate those. Okay? So it's possible to build up a structure that branches and that would be like an inorganic dendrimer analogous to organic dendrimers. Okay, now let me go to the question of some of our biological experiments, completely change of topic. This is something we've been working on for quite a few years now. It started by suggestions from Simon Weiss, who's been our close collaborator during most of this work. And the idea is, let's use for fluorescence labeling in biology these nanocrystals instead of using organic dyes. And you know that organic dyes are very commonly employed for labeling all kinds of things, cells in biology. And if you make a comparison between the two, what you see is that the semiconductor has a nearly continuous excitation spectrum, whereas the dye has a very discrete one. So you know that you could excite the semiconductors with one laser source and produce many different colors of emission. They'll each relax down to their band gap and emit. So that could be potentially quite important. And we have developed protocols that involve growing a thin layer of glass around the outside of the quantum dots. Very thin layer of glass is grown around the outside. That makes them biocompatible. And then we can attach different biological molecules onto the surfaces of the dots. And in this way, we can, in fact, use them for fluorescence labeling. So here you see these mouse fibroblasts. They're a certain type of cell. And the fibroblasts have been stained with the quantum dots rather than with organic dyes. And the staining works in the way that the cells have been exposed to alcohol, which puts holes in their membranes, and then one size of dot, the larger one, is directed to the actin fibers. So what you see here are the actin fibers, and these are two nuclei of the cells, and the green, the smaller size dots, have been directed to, or actually they haven't really been directed, but they tend in this case to go to the histone proteins that the DNA is wrapped around. So here are the actin fibers that give a cell its shape, and these are two cells next to each other, and you see that we've done a two-color labeling with one excitation source. And this is, the biologists think it's pretty important. It's spun off into a company, which you could imagine, and because it can be used because of many different reasons. It's of use for, so you see an example of another labeling experiment being performed there. So now let me tell you about what I think is a real biological application where it actually is of use to the biologists instead of just of potential use. Okay, and this is going to be to follow how cells move around in time. So here you see some experiments that we're doing with Carolyn Larrabell of UC San Francisco, who's in the anatomy department there. There's a cell here, and that white line kind of indicates the perimeter of the cell, and the cell has been exposed both to a fluorescent dye and to these colloidal silica-coated dots, and it simply eats both of them. Okay, and it brings them in, and I'll show you more about that in a minute, but both of them end up inside the cell. And now you'd like to follow them around for a while, and you see the big advantage of using the dots for the biological labeling is that over a period here of just 5 minutes of observation, the red color goes away because the dye has photobleached. Okay, the dye just is not robust enough to withstand the repeated cycles of excitation and de-excitation in the kind of complex environment inside the cell. The dots are perfectly happy, and here, for example, there is a vesicle that's got a pocket of dots in it, and it's moving. It's moving, actually, in this case, at a speed that's consistent with the dots being on a vesicle that's being transported. It's not just floating through the cell, but it's actually being transported by the machinery of the cell, and they can study that. Now, here is what we think is a really interesting application, and this is what we will call, quote, phagokinetic tracks. Okay, now what is that? It has to do with imaging everywhere a cell has gone. So here you see just a phase contrast image at 3 hours and 24 hours of some breast cancer cells. These are cells these are cancerous cells that have been plated out onto a substrate. But the substrate is not a normal tissue. It is a cell culture substrate with collagen coating, but on it has been deposited a very thin layer, a monolayer, of these quantum dots. Okay, so there's a layer of dots that have been put down, and if you look in phase contrast, you see the cells, and if you look in fluorescence, you just see the dots every place. And this is a superposition of those two. And what you see is at 24 hours, if you just look in phase contrast image, you see the cells again, but here you see these blank spots, okay, and then very bright things. Okay, the very bright things are the cells, okay, and the blank spots are everywhere the cell has gone. Okay, so the cells have crawled around, and every place that they've crawled, they've eaten the colloidal dots. Okay, they just engulfed them. That's because their actual process of moving involves engulfing some of the material that's under them. Okay, and that stuff is brought into the cell, and it stays there. And so these are, quote, phagokinetic tracks. And by looking at this, you can quantitatively say how much a cell has moved in a period of time. You can look at a very large population of cells and be very quantitative about how much the cell has moved in a certain period of time. Now, that turns out to be incredibly important because, you know, remember this image. It's moved around many diameters, okay? And if you look at healthy cells of the same type, but just not cancerous ones, they haven't moved around at all. And as you know, cancers tend to metastasize. They if you have a primary tumor, you can get a secondary tumor someplace else. And one of the main origins of that is that the cancerous cells crawl around. So if you can rapidly measure the motility of a cell, it's correlated with its metastatic potential. So by imaging these tracks, you can get a quick assessment as to whether cells are healthy or cancerous. The cells? Well, the cells will normally go through periods over which they'll grow and divide, and they continue to do that when the dots are present, just as they do when they're not. So
it has nothing to do with the dots.
Yeah, there's nothing to do with the dots. The dots are only there to provide a marker of what's going on. That's all they're doing. And here you can just see some images. Here's a healthy cell that has eaten dots. It's not that it doesn't eat them, but because it's not crawling around, it hasn't eaten very many. And that's the bottom line, is the more it crawls, the more dots are inside. And here you can just see some imaging, and you can kind of get a sense from confocal to photon microscopy of where the dots are inside the cell. And the answer is, if we label the DNA blue, okay, inside the nucleus, then you can see that the dots are all in vesicles that are around the nucleus. Okay, that's where the dots have all gone. These little glass-coated semiconductor particles, that's where they've gone. Okay, so that's the end of that part. And now, do I have 5 minutes, or I don't know what my time is?
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Okay. So just real quick, I'll tell you about experiments that we've been working on for several years. We started with Peter Schultz back in 96 doing this kind of work, and we've been slowly learning how to do it. And the idea is, can we take DNA and use it to take these nanocrystals and put them into arrangements that we would program? So for example, could you have a big one and two small ones next to each other, always in solution? We would assemble these things in parallel, many copies all at once, by having the DNA direct them into that arrangement. And the key to doing this is to counting, is that you have to count the number of DNAs per particle. So, for example, in the case of gold, we can attach DNA onto a particle, and when the DNA is attached, the mobility of the particle changes a lot. So these are some gold particles moving through a gel, and when DNA is attached, you suddenly start to see discrete bands that appear in the mobility, and those discrete bands correspond to particles that have 1, 2, 3 DNA strands attached. And if you add more DNA, then you see it shifts towards larger numbers of copies on the particle. And in fact, it turns out there's a whole project that we're engaged in. I'm not going to really go into it in detail, but depending on the type of particle, when you add DNA, the mobility of the particle can go up, it can become faster, or it can become slower, okay? And it all depends on the mechanism, the length of the DNA, and the number of charges present. So there's kind of an interesting question, how does the mobility change? But here we're only using it, we're only talking about the problem really of patterning. And so here you see some gels that we can isolate, for example, by the same mechanism. We're just running things through gels and collecting them. And you can see we can make dimers that correspond to two small crystals, two big crystals, or big and little. So we're just joining these things together in all the different ways that we could imagine at the small level. And where we are on this project is in the stage of isolating building blocks. So we run these gels, and then we can go through and identify what all these different peaks are. So for example, we can prepare this big, small, big, but we also can prepare big, small, with one extra unbase paired DNA on it. Okay, so this is now, we think of this, if we isolate this particular one, we think of this as a building block. We can keep that in a beaker, and now we can add it to another thing. For example, if we have, say, this one, we could attach two of these to this and start to build things up. So that's what we're trying to do, is use the DNA to prepare all different kinds of small groupings, have each one of those stored, and then start to take all of those groupings and put them together to make larger structures. And it looks to us like it's possible, at least, to get up to structures that have, by this method, with all these kinds of separations that I'm describing, which are laborious, we could get up to things that certainly have, you know, many tens of crystals all in a precise, they're not in a precise arrangement, but they're a precise composition. In other words, you would go and look at a particular entity, and it would have a precise number of crystals attached to each other, of certain sizes and compositions and so on. That's what the DNA can do. And we've also been able to do some of this, but not quite as well with the semiconductors. So here you see, for example, that in the case of the semiconductor particles, when we add DNA, they actually get faster. And we haven't been able yet in the case of the semiconductors to count the number of DNA strands per particle. Something we would like to do, and we're working on it, but it's a little bit tricky. So, but of course you can do sorting. So for example, if we have green nanocrystals and red nanocrystals, the DNA can be used to separate the two from each other very easily. Once they've already been labeled with a single strand, then the complementarity to a strand on a surface, for example, can be used to separate the two things out. And let me just emphasize, the idea here is just that if I think of a nanocrystal, it's 4 or 5 nanometers in diameter, and if I think of a DNA strand of the same length, that DNA strand will base pair at room temperature in a way that's thermally very stable. Okay, but because of its sequence, the DNA contains a lot of information. You know, DNA intrinsically contains information on the scale of nanometers. And these inorganic crystals contain functions on the scale of nanometers. So if you put the two things together, then you can program the assembly of functional units using the programmability of the DNA, but the functionality of the inorganic components. But that's what we would like to learn how to do. So I've shown you some recent experiments, a little bit about the liquid crystal work, which Langxi Li has really been developing. some of this imaging of, quote, phagokinetic tracks. That just means watching where the cells have gone, and a little bit about the DNA directed assembly. And thanks for your attention. Yes, that was done on the experiments where you saw them going bright and dark was done on individual rods, and because until recently we didn't think we had a way to align all of them, we're hoping soon that we'll have large numbers aligned and we can do, you know, ensemble also. Yeah. Oh. So, you know, that's just something that's been developed over many years in the single molecule community. If you just have molecules that are very dilute and they're further apart than the optical resolution of a microscope, then when you do your fluorescence imaging, you only see one. And then the only requirement is that the molecule be bright enough that you can see it and that it not destroy, that it doesn't, under the continuous irradiation, it doesn't blow up or something. And this fulfills both of those criteria. So, you know, it, so it's actually not, it's commonly done in many systems, you know. There's nothing, really not anything special in our work about that, yeah.
It's not my field, so. But it was fascinating to me that the cancerous cells move, and they do so by ingesting the stuff that's under them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that imply that if you could stop them from moving, you could stop them from growing and spreading?
Well, if you could stop them from moving, for sure they would, you know, be much less lethal. There's no because they wouldn't make second. Yeah, they would not metastasize, and so, you know, there is a chance that by binding the right stuff on the surfaces of these particles that would be helpful in some way, you know, and we're thinking about it, but we don't know, yeah. Right.
If you made a liquid phase with the arrows, would you make a new phase like bistatic?
Yeah, so the question is what would happen if we made liquid crystals with arrows? And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, we haven't done that at all. And all we've worked on so far are the two, you know, those two lengths and diameters of the rods. I mean, you saw most of the data we have, because it's a pretty new project. But you saw all the shapes that we can make, and presumably we could study all of them. So, you know, I don't have an answer to it, but it's really interesting. I mean, I think we'd like to take different shapes. We can make, I didn't show you all the shapes that we can make. We can make teardrops and other kinds of odd shapes, and they should show interesting kinds of packings as you go into this, you know. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, there may be lots of properties that these things have that are related but slightly different to the organic liquid crystals, and there may be many properties that I think the ability to combine the two together may be really interesting, because a lot of the things you do with nonlinear optics, for example, the performance can be much higher in inorganic materials than inorganic. So there's a lot of stuff to do with it from a materials perspective. Yeah.
Think about the possibility of the correction of DNA with the magnetic molecule and put it in a gradient of field and do some kind of electrophoresis, but with a
magnetophoresis. Yeah, sure. In fact, there are experiments like that, I should say, already. David Ben-Simon in Paris has a single DNA molecule. And then at the end of it has been attached a polymer sphere that has many magnetic particles inside, and when the field is applied, it stretches the DNA, and it can be, you know, and many beautiful things have been done with that, and certainly true that one of the things that we're working on is to go beyond gold and to have all the nanocrystals, each one with a certain sequence, each size and type with a certain sequence of DNA on it. and then those could be programmed into these things, and you could do all these things, electric, magnetic fields, whatever.
Yeah, because the particles of the maximum are very big.
Yes, they're very big. So it is clearly possible. So in this case, we've made cobalt particles, and now the cobalt particles have to go into water. There's a lot of stuff I put under the rug here we didn't talk about that relates to how do you get these small crystals to be biocompatible. And it's a long story. And so in the cobalt case, you don't want to form cobalt oxide, but you want it to be in water at pH 7. And so, there's a lot of, so we're trying to develop the coatings for doing that,
I'm thinking of small magnetic molecules.
Molecules. Oh, certainly that could be done. Yeah. The magnetic molecules don't have as big susceptibilities, but.
Yes.
Okay.
We have a question related to the previous one there. How do you prevent the molecule when you're tagging the attachment DNA to your microcrystal? How do you prevent the DNA from wrapping around the microcrystal?
Yeah.
Because the crystallics
command. Okay. So it's a complicated question. Let's say that we have negatively charged nanocrystals and the DNA itself is also negatively charged, okay? It turns out that even in that situation, the DNA will wrap around the particle, or it can, and it depends very delicately on the conditions. And the reason is the following. If you have a negative particle, metal particle, lots of negative charges, it can grow, it will have of necessity, in an ionic solution, a double layer around it. So it's got one layer of very tightly bound positive charges and then another layer of very weakly bound negative charges in this double layer that's quite close into the crystal. Now if you take all those individual ions that are negative, okay, and you replace them with one DNA, okay, the total charge hasn't changed at all, but all those charges that are connected together on the DNA displace individual charges that go off free into solution. So there's a tremendous entropic factor pushing the DNA onto the particle. And so that depends very delicately on the conditions of ionic strength, the curvature of the particle, the length of the DNA, what the counter ion is, all kinds of stuff like that. And we have found conditions that are very good, and we know, that we can really robustly do these hybridizations with dimers and trimers and so on. And it's taken us a really long time to get that to work. But we do have those conditions very reliably. And it depends on all these things that I've described to you. But at this point, I feel very confident in saying we know that the DNA can kind of just dangle off there. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.